I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jacqueline Jules, author of the new children's Jewish book and environmental fable called The Generous Fish. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, and our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is a leap year on the American calendar, which means this coming Saturday will be February 29th. Makes this a special week for all of us, I guess, but it's also particularly special for Jews, because this week we begin the Hebrew calendar month of Adar, happiest month of the Jewish year. And as we say, Mishenichnas Adar marbim besimcha. When you enter Adar, you multiply joy. I certainly hope that proves to be true for all of you two Jewish listeners. This may be midwinter for people in most northern hemisphere climates, but it's definitely the beginning of spring for us here in the Southwest and in Florida, where baseball spring training games are starting. That means it's time to play our classic welcome to the coming baseball season, Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Zu der Ball gehen, zum Eulen lo mir doch gehen. Käuf mir den nisslichen Cracker Jack, will ich kein Mulf und dort nicht weg. Jetzt ein Mut, die Ballspieler, es passt nicht, als man verspielt. Weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Steigs neues bei der Baseballspiel.
That was Nem Mir Ois Zu Dem Ball Game, as sung by Mandy Patinkin in his Yiddish version. The melody was written by Albert von Tilzer, a Jewish Tin Pan Alley songwriter from Indiana. Words were by Jack Norworth. When they wrote the song, neither of them had ever been to a baseball game, and that remained the case for each of them for decades. But their song certainly has made it to every ball game since it was first played at one in 1934. This is also the end of rodeo weekend here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West where I live. So we need a few Western themes this morning. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is here in Tucson unless you happen to live here and have lived here for at least a year or two, or, you know, 20 years like me. In Tucson, our rodeo week consists of a big non-mechanized parade followed by, this will shock you, a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days to go to the parade. They wear cowboy boots and hats and generally pretend all of us still have some connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. When you live in the heart of the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country not much over a century ago, rodeo can still seem like a pretty big deal. Actually, yesterday, my own congregation, Beit Simcha, did something that I don't believe had ever been done before we did it last year, an actual Shabbat afternoon service on horseback in the midst of a trail ride. It was awesome. Now, you might not immediately associate Jews and cowboys, but there were quite a number of Jews, even in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman, Wyatt Earp's common law wife, well, his last common-law wife, anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. And there were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, and outlaws, and there are photos of them that survive, wearing the appropriate linen dusters, cowboy boots, and gun belts. Some of them were involved in notorious incidents. If you aren't sure of that, go visit Boot Hill's Jewish Cemetery in Tombstone itself, where not a few of them are buried. And, of course, there were Jewish merchants, including some of my own ancestors, the Reinhardts, who had stores in the Gold Rush in the foothills of the Gold Country, somewhere near Auburn, California. They sold dungarees there, I expect, especially those newly invented ones with rivets, by a German-Jewish entrepreneur named Levi Strauss. I think some people still wear that brand. Anyway, in honor of all these Jewish cowboys, merchants, and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across the West, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143, walking the Soul Saloon like a man insane, and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. James Boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
That was the Ballad of Irving from an old album called You Don't Have to Be Jewish, redefining the Old West in classic shtick fashion. Our guest this morning, Jacqueline Jules, is author of the wonderful new Jewish children's book, The Generous Fish. Find out what traditional Jewish stories it's based on when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Jacqueline Jules is the author of some 40 books for young readers, including the award-winning Zapato Power Series, Feathers for Peacock. Her new book is called The Generous Fish. It's based on really two Midrashim, two Jewish stories, and it's kind of an environmental fable for young people. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
So tell us about the origins of this book.
Well, it's had a rather long origin, I would say. Many years ago, I first read the story by I.L. Peretz, Revelation, or The Story of the Billy Goat. And I was completely enchanted by this story.
It's a fascinating story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The story of the billy goat with his wondrous horns. And the horns are so wondrous that they can reach all the way into the heavens and pull down jewels from the Milky Way. And so this compassionate goat, he plucks these jewels from the Milky Way, and he puts them in the street for the community to pick up, and it helps their economic survival. But then later on, the people that live nearby want a little piece of his horns, and they want a little piece of his horns for a snuff box, of all things. And so one by one, everybody comes and takes just a little bit of that horn. And, you know, individually, what each person takes is not too much. But collectively, soon this wondrous billy goat has no more horns. And when I first read this story, I mean, it was years ago, it just really spoke to me as an adult and as a mother, and I shared it whenever I had a chance. And the idea of using this motif in a story kind of stayed with me for many years, but I couldn't find a way to really tell it for children because it has a very sad ending, of course. And much later, I realized it was really it could be used as a metaphor for our need to protect the environment. We use the Earth's natural resources to make our lives more comfortable, but we also have to use these resources responsibly and not to deplete the resources, no matter how good our reasons or intentions. So with a seed of the billy goat story in mind, I began to search for another Jewish tale with a miraculous creature, because I wasn't sure the snuff boxes and the billy goat would kind of work for today's young children's audience. I'm not sure they even know what a snuff box is.
I'm not sure I've ever seen a snuff box in my life, right?
So I realized that the snuff box wasn't going to work, and I couldn't figure out any other reason for taking the horn. So I started to search for another story with a miraculous creature, and because I realized that the billy goat creature wouldn't work. And there's a couple of stories about children who take the verse from Ecclesiastes, cast your bread upon the waters, very literally, whereas they throw the bread in the water, and they feed a fish every day until this fish grows miraculously big and saves the children. There's a story called The Water Witch and the Diamond Tree by Howard Schwartz and Barbara Rush. Ellen Frankel has a different story called Cast Your Bread Upon the Waters, but it also is about a child who throws a loaf of bread in the water every day, and the fish grows to an enormous size and then ultimately brings reward to the boy. So both of those stories have children who take this biblical verse very literally. So somehow, after much thought, thinking about it, I thought, well, could I combine these two stories? Could I have a child feed a fish, which is, you know, children take things very literally.
Yes, they do.
Cast your bread upon the waters, and let's take it very literally. And so I thought that was very, very child-friendly, and the idea of a giant fish is also very, very attractive.
Kids like big fish.
Yes, yes. Well, they also like just miraculous creatures.
Yes, they do.
And the sea is always a great setting. And so then I, you know, realized, well, maybe the fish could have golden scales, and the people of the town.
Well, don't give away the whole story. We'll come back with the generous fish and its golden scales with Jackie Jules in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is in our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are all ongoing. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our synagogue is at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. Purim is coming up fast. Our world-class Megillah reading and raucous celebrations Monday night, March 9th, with a kids' carnival on Sunday, March 8th. Don't miss it. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona and the fastest growing in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You have a new favorite place in some of your many travels, which is Montenegro, where you have become friendly with the chief rabbi of Montenegro. Tell us a little bit about that small country in the Balkans and the Jewish community there, such as it is.
Happily. I think I may have mentioned once before on your show that I attended a big conference called Machar, which is the Hebrew word for tomorrow.
You talked about it, that's right.
In a coastal town called Budva in Montenegro. So Montenegro is this tiny country wedged between Albania, Croatia, Macedonia, Kosovo, et cetera, et cetera. It's this kind of backwater, highly mountainous place that has a beautiful shoreline.
Gorgeous
and
coastline there.
The Bay of Kotor, which is one of the natural wonders of the world.
Really beautiful. I've been there myself.
The easiest way to get there is to fly to the Dubrovnik Airport, and when you go out of the airport, if you turn right and drive for 20 minutes, you're in downtown Dubrovnik. If you turn left and drive for 20 minutes, you're at the border with Montenegro. So it happens that at that conference that I went to at the end of October, a Chabad rabbi named Ari Edelkopf, originally from Los Angeles, was
the source of all great rabbis.
Of course, inaugurated, consecrated, whatever the proper word is, as the chief rabbi of Montenegro. He's also the only rabbi of Montenegro, which historically has never really had an organized Jewish community. Well, there is one now with his staff, and this rabbi succeeds at sniffing out Jews in the most unlikely places in the world. I mean, there is a tiny town at the southern end of the Montenegrin coast, right before the border of Albania, called Ulcin, which at one point in its history was a port for the slave trade. And there are still some black inhabitants of Ulcin, some African.
From the period when it was
right
in the slave trade, wow.
And also, the further south you go, the more Albanian cultural influence there is, so there's more Muslims. Montenegro now has four official religions. Islam,
Orthodoxy,
basically the Serbian Orthodox Church, in effect.
Yeah.
The Roman Catholic Church, because their neighbors in Croatia are all Roman Catholics, and Judaism, as of like a year or two ago. They signed a decree. So, and they gave space to the nascent Jewish community for a community center and a synagogue in the capital, which since the breakup of the former Yugoslavia changed its name from Titograd to Podgorica, which I think was actually its original name in the days before Tito.
Tito, right.
Anyway, it's upland in the mountains, and because that's the capital of the country, that's where the chief rabbi makes his home and his office and all that. And I'm going to be in Montenegro basically next month with a few close friends, and he said, you have to come to my house for dinner. My wife's the greatest cook. It's the only kosher food in the country. Come. So I accepted with pleasure, and my friends are really eagerly looking forward to meeting the chief rabbi of Montenegro, especially because there won't be any language barriers since he grew up in Los Angeles.
No question. Although, you know, there may be some language barriers. We speak a little differently in L.A.
Yeah, right.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great trip there. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective segment. Bernie Sanders, the first Jew ever to win a primary election or even a caucus, is now the apparent frontrunner in the race for the Democratic nomination for president. Among his main competitors at this point, well, no one really knows yet, but lots of people sure think they do, is Michael Bloomberg, another Jewish candidate. As the candidacies of Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren seem to fade, that means it's at least reasonably likely that the top contenders for the candidate who will oppose Donald Trump in the fall will be Jewish. To call this period of American presidential politics unprecedented doesn't quite capture how wild things have gotten. Even if Donald Trump were a normal president, which he is certainly not, this would be a unique situation. No Jewish candidate has ever before become the nominee of either the Democrats or the Republicans. The closest was the vice presidential candidacy of Senator Joe Lieberman, Al Gore's running mate, back in the year 2000. Lieberman's own campaign for president in 2004 never really gained traction. Bernie Sanders' effective run 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton, the first woman ever nominated for president by a major party, of course, was a surprise to almost everybody in politics. And now, 4 years later, Bernie Sanders appears to be surging into front-runner status. So far this season, we've had an array of quote-unquote front-runners for the Democratic Party nomination, of course. First it was Joe Biden, then briefly Kamala Harris, who has since dropped out, then Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg sticking around and favored at times, but Bernie Sanders now appears to be the clear front-runner, with perhaps Mike Bloomberg gaining support rapidly. You know the old joke, when you have two Jews, you have three opinions. Well, now you apparently have two Jews and two prominent presidential candidates. Kind of hard to believe. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish boy, Yossi, enters a barber shop, and the barber whispers to his customer, "This is the dumbest kid in the world. Watch, I'll prove it to you." The barber puts a dollar bill in one hand and two quarters in the other, and then calls Yossi over and asks, "Which do you want, son?" Yossi takes the quarters and leaves. "What did I tell you?" said the barber. "That kid never learns." Later, when the customer walks out, he sees the same young boy, Yossi, coming out of a candy store. "Hey, son, why did you take the quarters instead of the dollar bill?" Yossi takes a bite of candy and replies, "Because the day I take the dollar, the game is over." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, young representatives of Israel here in America, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Israel has, eight and a half million people in the whole country, and there's close to 2 million Arabs, something like that, that are Arab Israelis. They're citizens of Israel. They vote in elections. They go to school. You guys growing up, Danielle, you in the Emek Yisrael in the Jezreel Valley, Shai in Ramat Gan, a very nice suburb of Tel Aviv. How many Arabs did you know in your school? How many did you know growing up?
So for me, it's like actually zero. I studied in, I live in a neighborhood in Ramat Gan, so it's also like kind of a bubble, and it's a kind of big neighborhood, so it's like more bubbly. And in my school, elementary school, not zero Arabs. In my high school, 2,000 kids, zero Arabs. I used to compete on skiing. I used to be a skier, and I knew one Druze guy from Majdal Shams, which is close to Ramat Golan.
Yeah. Well, Golan close Heights. To the snow. You should be a good skier if you're from Majdal Shams.
So that's the only...
That's the only Jewish guy that I knew growing up until you were 18, really.
Yes, yes.
Danielle, how about you?
So for me, I also have a pretty huge school, but the amount of Arabs that I have there are very much like, I could say like 10-ish maybe, not too many. Most of the Arabs are boys that go to boarding school that is in my village where my school is, and they just go for soccer.
So it's like a soccer boarding school, like a boarding school for the guys who are really good at soccer.
Yeah, so they go to school, then after school they have just training, and that's...
So they don't really interact with kids who are not in the boarding school. They're the only ones in your whole village that are kids your age.
Yeah, but there's one girl actually, well, actually a few. A girl, she's... half Jewish, half Druze, or I can't remember. Mm-hmm. So her dad is Druze, and he married a Jewish woman, right? So there's been also a lot around her, because there was a movie about her, and it got one first place in this movie award thing.
But she's kind of famous.
So she is kind of famous because she has a very interesting story, because she's a Jew, and then she lives with her family in the Arab village. So for her, it's very complicated. But so this is something that is actually, like, happens a few times, like in my area, that whole mixing thing.
Pretty fascinating that here you guys who are such engaging, smart, well-educated young Israelis have really not had any deep interaction with any Arabs throughout your entire life, even though they form something like a quarter of the population of Israel. Very interesting. You know, there's an old song, Kulanu Yehudim, like everybody in Israel is Jewish. They're Jewish from somewhere, you know, everywhere around the world, but they're all Jewish. And that's not really true, but it does seem like maybe that's how things have gone within the culture. As you said, a bubble.
Yes.
Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Merhaba.
And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of the Jewish religious experience today, in our portion of Truma this week, God commands the Israelites, Asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham, make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building the Ark of the Covenant are explained in detail. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place in which God's presence will most closely be found, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing occurs. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build this holy structure needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for or required. May it happen again sometime soon to us. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a free will offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous offering is a powerful thing indeed, for when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, immediately fills with God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today in time, love, care, funds, we seek to recreate that free will offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our own lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fervor. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who remain together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color as we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet, held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass. May we also find the love of God and holiness in our own congregation's sanctuary, this Shabbat, and always. When we return, our guest, Jackie Jules, explores the Jewish sources for her new book and its inspiration in literature and midrash. Find out about the environmental meaning as well when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the midst of a rash of presidential pardons issued last week by President Donald Trump, including one to the corrupt former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, Trump cited the incredible job that Michael Milken has done in funding cancer research over the past three decades, and he pardoned the 1980s junk bond king. Milken, who gives to Jewish philanthropic endeavors in education, health, and human services, as well as Israeli causes, was among the 11 people who were given clemency last week by Trump. Supporters of a pardon for Milken, including the Jewish billionaire businessman Sheldon Adelson and New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft, both also major givers to Jewish causes. Milken pled guilty in 1990 to racketeering and securities fraud charges stemming from his work heading the bond department of the now defunct investment bank Drexel Burnham Lambert. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, the term reduced to 2 years because Milken cooperated with federal authorities in the investigation into insider trading and junk bonds. He was also fined hundreds of millions of dollars. Milken's pardon does not affect his lifetime ban from working in the securities industry. Since his release, Mr. Milken has dedicated his life to philanthropy, continuing charitable work that he began before his indictment, Trump's press secretary Stephanie Grisham said. She also said the charges filed against Mr. Milken were truly novel. I don't know what that means. Milken joins a list of celebrity pardons issued last week by Trump and earlier, including former 49ers owner Eddie DiBartolo Jr., Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Dinesh D'Souza, and Scooter Libby. Perhaps in that same spirit, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has asked President Reuven Rivlin of Israel to expunge his criminal record. If Rivlin agrees, Olmert would have his conviction on moral turpitude erased, clearing the way for a possible return to a run for public office. Under Israeli law, politicians convicted of moral turpitude are prevented from running for 7 years following their release. Olmert was released from prison in 2017. Olmert has talked about returning to public life, although it's not clear if he would consider again running for Knesset. His attorneys made the request last week. Rivlin turned down a previous request in 2018 when Olmert was still in prison, but he did lift all parole restrictions from Olmert 2 days after his release. Olmert served 16 months of a 27-month sentence. Earlier this month, Olmert joined Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in New York to reject the Trump administration's recently unveiled peace plan and to call for new negotiations based on where the two leaders left off 12 years ago in 2008. Olmert was the first Israeli prime minister to serve time in prison and to be sentenced to jail. He resigned in September 2008 after police investigators recommended he be indicted in multiple corruption scandals. And while we are on the subject of Israeli prime ministerial corruption, the trial of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu opens March 17th in Jerusalem, 2 weeks after Israel holds its latest national election. There are no jury trials in Israel. A three-judge panel of the Jerusalem District Court will hear Netanyahu's case. The chairwoman, Rivka Friedman-Feldman, was a member of the panel in 2014 that sentenced Ehud Olmert to 8 months in prison. Netanyahu was charged in November in three corruption cases, marking the first time a sitting Israeli prime minister was indicted. Olmert had stepped down prior to his own indictment for bribery. Israel will hold its elections third in less than a year, March 2nd, amid coalition negotiations as Netanyahu fights to hold on to political power. His defense team is expected to request Netanyahu be exempt from appearing in court, arguing that requiring him to participate will interfere with his work as prime minister or a lawmaker. The most recent poll by Israel's Channel 13 shows the Blue and White Party, led by Benny Gantz and its coalition, with 36 seats in the upcoming Knesset, followed by Netanyahu's Likud party with 33 seats. That means that once again we can anticipate no one party will be able to secure a majority coalition to establish an official government. More elections to come? Who knows? And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning, Jacqueline Jules. Jackie Jules is the author of 40-some books for young readers. Her title, Never Say a Mean Word Again, won a Sidney Taylor Honor Award, is a recipient of a 2014 ESOP accolade. Former school librarian and teacher, she has written a wonderful book called The Generous Fish. We were talking about its origins in part in a Yitzhak Leib Peretz story. Peretz, of course, the great Yiddish writer and fantastic fable about the goat and its horns, and you told us earlier how it turned into a fish with golden scales. Tell us a little bit more about the evolution of the book.
Well, once I came up with the idea that we could have a giant fish with golden scales that one could accidentally fall off, and a young boy brings it back to town, and all the people realize, well, a golden scale, this could help us economically. The same as with the goat who brought down the jewels from the Milky Way. And it was very important to me that I had everyone in the story who asked for a golden scale had a really good reason. They weren't just they didn't just want the golden scales for greedy reasons. They wanted it for good reasons, and that's our conflict and our tension with our environment. We very often want to do developments and use our natural resources for economic reasons, to promote economic growth, but we also have to be careful of how we do that, and to do it responsibly. And in this story, the community, each individual wants something, but at the expense of this miraculous creature. And we have to think about community needs sometimes, and put them above our personal needs.
I know that frequently children's book authors work completely independently of illustrators. Is that how it worked with this book?
Oh yes, that's the norm, actually, with a publishing house. My job is to create a picture for the reader with my words, and if I have succeeded, an illustrator will be inspired to create the visual images for my text. And a picture book is a collaborative effort. The author works with the editor to create the best text possible, and then the editor then works with the illustrator for the best representation of those words. And in the publishing industry, they really want the illustrator to be free to add these extra dimensions rather than being directed by the author. I don't think in pictures. I think in words, and I also think as a storyteller. So leaving it to the illustrator creates a much better product than if I would be telling the illustrator what to do.
You mentioned the other inspirations from Ellen Frankel, and are there other kids' book authors that you particularly like?
Oh, I'm such an avid...
As a librarian, you must have had a little bit of a taste for other people's books.
Oh, yes. I mean, it just... And so many of them are my friends. I'm afraid that if I say one that I would feel bad that I left somebody else out. I read a lot of Jewish folklore and a lot of Midrash, and because I worked as a Jewish librarian, and I really like going and some of my tales have been retold from very old tales. When I worked as a Jewish librarian, I was also in charge of book sales, old book sales, and it was terrible because I would buy a lot of these books that I was selling. So I have this collection. So, I mean, I'm really, really a fan of old tales and being able to retell them. The Hardest Word, which is one of my books, is retold from an old Hasidic folk tale. Many of my Jewish stories have their roots in Midrash and traditional literature. As I said, I have so many friends in the children's book industry, I'd be afraid to mention.
Don't want to offend anybody, I understand.
Well, not just offend people, I would feel bad because, you know, I would feel bad that I didn't mention them too. Because I have so many favorites. Children very often ask you, well, who's your favorite author and what's your favorite film or what's this? And I'm having a favorite is hard for me to decide. That's like saying, you know, which one of my grandchildren do I like the best? And that I can't decide either. I would certainly not decide that either.
Well, I mean, there are people who can't decide which collection of Midrashim they like the best. So,
Yeah,
I understand. In the afterword of your book, you write, you know, pretty clearly about what, you know, it's an author's note, but it's really, I'm sure, more text than is in the rest of the book combined by a good margin. And you talk about the economics concept, the problem known as the tragedy of the commons. Can you explain that to people?
Well, it refers to the importance of using resources responsibly. You have to think of the community, not just of your personal needs. And sometimes we have to put the community before our personal needs, particularly when we're thinking about natural resources or the health of an endangered creature.
You also explore, as you mentioned, you explore Midrashim, but you talk about certain really crucial Jewish commandments, in particular the environmental commandment, Bal Tashchit, do not destroy, based on Deuteronomy. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, the text says that soldiers must not cut down fruit trees during a war, and the rabbis have later interpreted this verse to ban all wasteful destruction. And in the story, the rabbi says, distinctly that Reuven reminded them that all creatures are important. And I think that's something we need to remember, that all creatures are important.
So what's the sequel to The Generous Fish?
Oh, I haven't gotten that far. I haven't. I'm always working on something, but I haven't thought about a sequel to the Generous Fish. Some of my my Ziz books ended up having three sequels, but that's a good thought. I'll have to think about.
Yeah, I have to tell you that one of your Ziz books was one of my kids' favorites growing up. So,
thank you so much to hear that.
No,
that's wonderful to hear.
You know, it's funny. there's a time for every parent when you realize that most of the books you're reading are ones you've read 15 or 20 or 500 times to your child, and you come to memorize certain books. And then you don't always turn back to them. Do you find that people look back at your books later?
Well, you certainly hope so. I know that, I was a teacher and a librarian for many years, and I know that it really builds literacy skills for a child to hear a story over and over and over, whereas parents don't necessarily want to hear it over and over and over again. But that's very good for a child and their development, their literacy development, too. And every time they'll see something different in the story, or they'll... And it can be a really special experience to read a story over and over with a child and see how much they enjoy it and how they take command of it with repeated readings. And in the classroom, frequently a teacher will go over a text many, many times, because that's how you build fluency, that's how you build understanding.
Do you think your books contribute to building Jewish literacy as well?
I hope so. That has been my, that when I first started writing only Jewish books, and that was my hope, that was my desire to contribute to the body of literature for Jewish children. So that was my dream. So if even a little bit of that has come true, that would be very gratifying.
I think it's beautiful. The book is called The Generous Fish, and it's a beautiful fable, really a contemporary fable based on not an ancient one, but an early modern one, let's say, a 150 or something year old book. Tell us where people can go to find out more about you and about your book.
Well, you can go to my website at jacquelinejules.com. You can also go to the publisher's website at wisdomtales.com, and it's available at your independent bookstore and online and wherever books are available.
And by the way, if it inspires people to read Yitzchak Leib Peretz in translation or in the original, you've done a great mitzvah, because he's one of the great and not terribly well-remembered authors, I think, in Jewish history.
Oh, but his stories are wonderful.
Aren't they fantastic? They're usually a little bit sardonic. They have a kind of a twist at the end. And, you know, in your book, you found a way to make it sweeter and more harmonized. That's probably not even a word, but you've harmonized it more.
Yeah, well, many stories that I have come across that have enchanted me as an adult, I've really struggled to find a way to tell them for children. And it's very often taken me years before I figured out a way.
Thank you so much, Jackie, and all the best.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is in our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are all ongoing. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our synagogue is at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. Purim is coming up fast. Our world-class Megillah reading and raucous celebrations Monday night, March 9th, with a kids' carnival on Sunday, March 8th. Don't miss it. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona and the fastest growing in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Rabbi Stanley Davids, author of the new book, Deepening the Dialogue, Jewish Americans and Israelis Envisioning the Jewish Democratic State. Our playout this morning comes from Brazilian singer-songwriter Gilbert Brito, his setting of Kol Dodi, a passage from the Song of Songs, the voice of my beloved, here she comes. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
Amen.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.